Osho, Christianity, the deadliest poison, and Zen, the antidote to all poisons. Talks given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India. Discourse number 6.
Our beloved Master, once, when Onjan was in Yakuzan's presence, the Master said to him, "What does Haikujo Osho usually teach?" Onjan replied, "He says, go beyond three phrases, or go beyond six phrases and get it." Yakuzan commented, "With a distance of 700 miles between us, fortunately, we don't have anything to do with Hayakujo." But then he continued, "What else does he teach?" Ungan said, "Once, after the discourse, when the congregation stood up from their seats, Hayakujo called out to them. When they looked back at the Master, Hayakujo said, 'What is that?'" Yaku-san commented, "You should have said that earlier. Hayakujo is still doing well. Thanks to you, I was able to see Hayakujo."
Friend, the Christians have been claiming that they have discovered the world. It is just holy shit. Columbus never discovered America. He rediscovered it. It has been discovered many times before. And there are valid evidences of it. In Turkey, there is a map which has been by scientists decided to be 700 years old. It is a world map, America included in it. And it looks so contemporary. What we see in the modern map is everything available in that map. Not only it means that America was known to the man who made the map, it also implies that such a map cannot be made without a flying machine. Without an aeroplane, such a map is impossible. You cannot see a bird's eye view of the whole continent, of the whole world, from every angle. You cannot make a map of India sitting here. Every nook and corner so thinly is drawn in the map. So it is a propaganda of the Christians that Columbus discovered America. Before him, America was perfectly well known, not only America, but the whole world that we know as today. The maps have not changed at all. But this was not the first time that the map was made of America 700 years ago. 5,000 years ago, one of the great warriors of India, Arjuna, has married a Mexican woman. In Sanskrit, the name of Mexico is Maxica. From Maxica, Mexico is derived. One of the most scholarly Buddhist monks, Bhikshu Chamanlal, has written a book that Christians go on ignoring. The name of the book is Hindu America. Because everywhere in Mexico and other parts, Hindu gods have been found. Temples devoted to Hindu gods. Statues of Hindu gods. The shape of the temple is the shape of the Hindu temple. But not only Chamanlal has proved it definitively, that there was a time that the whole America was converted to Hinduism. He has also found places which Christians will be shocked to know. There are fields in many forests of South America which have strange signs on them. Those signs can be understood only by if you are high above in the sky from an aeroplane, and the planes are exactly meant to be airports. Those symbols are simply made to understand the pilots that they are above the airport. You cannot make any sense. The signs are so big, standing on the ground, you cannot see the whole sign. And such vast plains, so clean, that even now, after thousands of years, aeroplanes can land on those airports. There was no other use for those to make if there were no aeroplanes. In Sanskrit, the aeroplane is called Viman. And there are so many descriptions in so many scriptures that they have to be understood with great detail. In Mahabharata, the aeroplane is described. Perhaps a far better version than we know yet. Because it was not fueled by petrol. It used to have a certain precious stone on top of it, which absorbs the sun rays, and through those sun rays the aeroplane was fueled. That was a far developed version than our aeroplane. We are wasting all petrol on aeroplanes, on cars. In Mahabharata, which is 5,000 years old, they have found how to use solar energy. And the Christians go on insisting that we have civilized the world. Socrates was not civilized, Gautam Buddha was not civilized, Lao Tzu was not civilized, Confucius was not civilized. Before even Jesus Christ was born, 3,000 years before, China has discovered alphabets, gunpowder, and all kinds of technological devices. Before the birth of Jesus, thousands of years before, in the Mahabharata, all kinds of weapons are used which were not available to our intelligence. We thought they are just mythology, but atomic energy has proved that they were not mythology, they were atomic weapons. Mahavira was 500 years before Jesus, and he was the 24th Tirthankara of the Jainas. The first Tirthankara of the Jainas is mentioned in the ancient most book in the world, Rig Veda, Adinatha. With such deep respect, that was culture. It was Adinatha who founded Jainism and separated from Hinduism. But Hindu's most sacred book does not condemn him, does not criticize him. He criticized everything that Hindus had believed for centuries. The caste system, he was against. He was against Manu and his commandments to the Hindus. He was against the Brahmin priests, but still, this was culture. In Rig Veda, they have very respectfully remembered Adinatha, that he was a unique man, a great man, a man of tremendous understanding. It does not matter that we don't agree with each other, but we can respect each other. And you say, we civilize the world, Christians. You don't know about anything before Jesus Christ. China was already a civilized country. India was always, for thousands of years before Jesus, was absolutely a civilized country. Christians have to come down from their propaganda machine. What do they know of culture? In India, there flourished hundreds of philosophies, and every philosopher criticized others as severely as possible, but with great respect. It was not a question of criticizing the other philosophers. It was a question of finding the truth. And that is the aim of all thinkers and philosophers and theologians. So you may disagree, but you cannot be disrespectful. Jainism or Buddhism are the most civilized religions of the world. They don't have killed anybody, not a single person, in the effort to convert him. And Christian Church calls itself that it is the militant church. Militant church? Certainly, Christians have killed more people in the world than any other religion. It is a militant church. It used to have great armies. It used to send armies to convert pagans. And pagans were beautiful people, far more beautiful than any Christian. Pagans were nature worshippers. They loved the trees, they loved the rivers, they loved the mountains, they loved the stars, the sun, moon. That was their world. There was no God, there was no hell, there was no heaven. This very life was paradise. What Buddha has said, pagans would have said, but Christianity has killed them or converted them. Now there are no more any pagans. They were the most joyous people who loved, who lived abundantly without any fear and greed. But Buddha has said a statement which is certainly a pagan statement. Buddha said, this very body is the Buddha, and this very earth, the lotus paradise. That statement contains the whole philosophy of the pagans. But Christians treated pagans as subhuman race. They were not human beings. So to kill them was just like killing, hunting animals. What Christians have done is exploiting the whole world, not discovering. What they have done in Australia, they used to kill the natives just as hunters kill animals. They have almost destroyed the native population of Australia. Killing human beings as a game. And the people who had reached Australia were the criminals expelled from England. They had committed murder, they had committed rapes and all kinds of heinous crimes. They needed crucifixion, but rather than crucifying them because they were English, England simply sent them out of the country. And these people became in Australia presidents, prime ministers, super rich people, the most cultured, and they were killing human beings like animals. The same has happened in America, not on such a vast scale, but it's still the same. Criminals reached America, expelled criminals from England. Two states they have founded, and two states they were the governors, and they simply killed people. And when other people came from other European countries, they discharged the Red Indians, the natives of America. Those who have survived, they have forced them into deep forests. They call it reservation, but it is a change of world. It is concentration camp with a sophistication that Adolf Hitler was not aware. He had to create electric barbed wires around the concentration camp. The people who reached America managed in a far more beautiful way. First, they killed most of the natives. Then small pockets of natives were given pensions, so they don't come into the mainstream life of America. They have to remain in the forest. They are not educated, but they are given good pensions because their land has been taken. It looks very civilized. On the surface only, inside, their story is totally different. They have been given pension and no work. Now what they will do with their money? They gamble, they drink, in their drunkenness, their whole life is wasted. And they go on creating more and more children because each children brings more pension. They are uneducated. They are not allowed to enter into the mainstream world of America. And they are given so much money. Such a cunning strategy. With so much money, what they will do? They will gamble, they will rape, they will have prostitutes, they will drink their whole life. They don't think at all that this country is theirs. They don't have that much consciousness left. That's why they cannot revolt. In fact, revolution would be dangerous to their pension. So this is a far sophisticated electric barbed wiring around. They can't even raise the voice for liberation, for freedom, because freedom will mean who will give them the pensions without work. It is better to keep silent and just go on drinking and raping and gambling. That is their whole life. And much land was acquired by killing, but just to show to the world, few pieces of land were purchased. But you will be surprised, it was purchasing with a loaded gun on the chest of the man to whom the land belonged. This way, New York was purchased in $90. The whole city of New York. $90. Can you conceive? Just 300 years before. And most of the land that has been purchased the same way as New York. But they had a satisfaction that they are paying for the land. When I was investigated in America, they asked me questions. I had to answer them by other questions. I told the man, the chief of the immigration services, that what do you think about yourself? You are a foreigner, I am a foreigner. You are a little older foreigner. You came 300 years before. I am fresh. But don't think that this land belongs to you. And who are to judge? You enter this country without any visa and without any entry permit. And you enter this country as invader. I am entering this country with a visa, with entry permit, as a tourist. And if you have any honesty about which Christians claim so much, you should leave this country immediately. It is not your land. And your hands are full of blood. And you are deceiving the whole world and deceiving yourself. You made the constitution in somebody else's land and you talk about freedom, and you talk about freedom of speech, and you talk about respect for the individual. What you have done to the native, that was respect. And against your own constitution, you are keeping those people as slaves. And you are occupying their country. And you want me to ask for a permit to be a resident here? Foreigners asking foreigners? And I have purchased the land, and not like you. You have paid for New York $90. We have paid for Rajneeshpuram, $6 million. And we have invested in the commune, $300 million. And we have not invaded anybody. But the commune, which was flourishing, the whole America was taken by the commune. Most taken were the Christians who think they are civilized. It was the fundamentalist Christian President Ronald Reagan, under the influence and pressure of the church, that destroyed this commune, that is dangerous, because it is taking young people from the Christian fold. You go on taking people from Hindu fold, from Mohammedan fold, from Buddhist fold, and that is absolutely right. And if I was, and I was not converting anybody into any religion, only the very intelligent people had come on their own accord, and they were free to leave any moment. It is not a religion, it is a caravan of seekers of truth. Nobody is converted, everybody has joined the caravan, the commune, on his own accord. His freedom is intact, his individuality is respected. It has been asked to me that there had been before you Hindu monks, Jaina monks, Buddhist monks, but nobody was condemned. Why your commune was destroyed by America by force? The reason is clear. Vivekananda was the first to enter America from India. But he behaved like a politician. He praised Christianity. And he said all religions are one. And he has not taken anybody out of the Christian fold. He never criticized a single Christian dogma. Naturally, there was no question. He had no commune. He was just a visitor praising. People loved him because their religion is being praised by an outsider. The same was done by Ramatirtha. And the same has been done by Maharishi Yogi and other sannyasins of Hinduism. They all praise Christianity. Christians are happy. I am not going to praise any lies, any poisons, any untruths. I am going to say straightforward what is what. That was the problem for them. They could not understand how to argue with me. I was in America 5 years fighting in all the courts. My visa was finished long ago. I had no visa, no entry, but they had not the guts even to come into the commune. They were surrounding the whole commune. The commune had 126 square miles. They were surrounding the whole commune with the National Guard, with machine guns. But they did not dare to enter into the commune. And we had nothing, just 13 half-automatic guns, which are available in America to any citizen. And these belong to the police force of the commune, which was paid by the American government. Because the police force belonged to the American police force. Although all the people were sannyasins who had taken the training of the police, so they were afraid that although the police force is ours, but it is going to fight for the commune, not for us. But the greatest power in the world was afraid of 30 half-automatic guns, and they were planning for years and years how to arrest me. And I don't have even a paper knife. To arrest me is so easy. There is no need to handcuff me, there is no need to put chains on me. You just tell me that you are invited. To the presidential guest house, the jail. And I would have gone with them. There was no question about it. But you will be surprised, they asked CIA to arrest me, the head laughed. He said, a single individual who has not committed any crime, and you ask us to arrest him, we will not. Even the head of the army was asked. He simply laughed that, have you gone mad? Has ever been army called to arrest a single individual who has nothing in his hands to fight? You will make us a laughing stock all over the world. He refused. All government agencies refused to arrest him. For the simple reason, because they could not show any reason why I should be arrested. And they could not say that I don't have a visa. My visa is expired long before. They could not say it because I have applied for renewing the visa. And they have not answered. They were afraid if they say no, I am going to take them to the court. Up to the Supreme Court, it will take 20 years at least to decide the matter. So no, they could not say. Yes, they would not say. So they did not tell to the army or to the government agencies that the reason to arrest is that he is living in America without any visa, without any entry. But it was their fault, not mine. I have asked them again and again that either you say no or you say yes. But they could not say either. Yes, they could not say because of the Christian church was pressuring them that I should be thrown out of the country. Because once I am thrown out of the country, the commune will disperse. They had gathered out of love and gratitude around me. Otherwise, there was no reason to be in that desert. We transformed the desert into a garden. It was for sale for 40 years. Nobody was ready to purchase it at any price. What you will do with that desert? But our creative people made houses, made dams, created a small river. We had enough water in our dams, even if for 5 years there was no rain, we have a reservation of water. We had planted so many trees that it was not going to be long that the trees will attract the clouds. We were cultivating in the desert enough food for the commune. Within 5 years more, and the commune would have been absolutely independent. We had our own cows for milk, we have our own hens for people's breakfast. We had our own fields, we had our own greenhouses, because in the desert the sun is so hot, unless you make a greenhouse, we have our own greenhouses for vegetables, for fruits. And this all was happening while we were fighting with the government in every court, and they were putting imaginary cases. But once you put a case, you have to fight it. We have the greatest law firm in the whole world. Two of the attorneys are here, Anando, Sangeet, and I think Niren was here just 2 days before. Perhaps he may be here. We had 400 people in the law firm. 400 people continuously working to fight the whole American law and constitution. If they had depended simply on law, there was no way to destroy the commune. But they dropped all law, all constitution. They were simply mad. And the madness is not part of a cultured religion. It is not civilization. We have not thrown out the Christian missionaries from India. They go on converting people to the Catholic fold. But if people want to be Catholics, it is perfectly okay. It is their choice. The government has nothing to object. It has given freedom of religion. American Constitution also makes it clear that states should not interfere in religious matters, but they interfere. They crushed and destroyed our commune. Just now I have received a few pictures. Even after 5 years in the desert, the trees that we have planted there are so green, such great height they have achieved, such beautiful shadow underneath. They are still waiting. But the government has not only deported me for 5 years, it has also made arrangements for another 5 years, suspended jail. If I enter America after 5 years, they can put me in jail on any excuse, imaginary, and I will not have any recourse to appeal for 5 years. So in fact, for 10 years they have prevented me. In 10 years, those trees won't survive. Those 300 peacocks in my garden, they have been catching them and selling them. They could get only 150. 150 have escaped in the mountains. They will not be able to survive. the dam needs continuous care, in 10 years it will not be able to contain overflow water. We were continuously on guard that no water overflows the dam. Once the water starts overflowing, soon the dam will be destroyed. And the whole commune land is below the dam. It will be flooded with water. That will destroy all the houses that we have made for 3,000 people to live. All the roads that we have created. And we were not employing any laborers. Doctors, surgeons, professors, teachers, all kinds of educated people were creating roads, making houses, making gardens, lawns. We had one of the best hotels with 240 rooms, a 5-star hotel in the desert. The whole commune was centrally air-conditioned. Now what will happen to all that? Just few months before, a picture has been sent to me by a sannyasin. Because they did not allow me even to stay one day after I was released. They told me that I had to leave immediately. They were afraid if I stay even one day, there are possibilities to appeal to the High Court, to the Supreme Court. 15 minutes and my jet plane has been kept running on engine, that immediately I should be taken to the airport and taken out of America. I could not go back to the commune just to say goodbye to my people. I was prohibited, even when they gave me bail, they made it absolutely certain that I don't leave the commune. Every day a phone will come and I have to answer the phone, and I cannot use aeroplanes. We had 5 aeroplanes in the commune. I wanted to go to the commune at least to tell to my people that don't be worried, even if I am not here, you continue. You will feel my presence. And 10 years will pass, 5 years have passed. 5 years will pass also. I will be back. But they did not allow me even to go back to the commune. And just few months before, I received a picture. We had, those who were in the commune will remember, just before the assembly hall, we had the signs of 2 birds flying. Just as you enter from the road towards the assembly hall, a picture has been sent to me that some fanatic Christian has shot those symbolic birds, 20 holes with guns. These are civilized people? And it was only painted words. not even living birds. But such anger, such violence, they must have stolen every house, everything that they could carry. They must have destroyed everything that we have managed so beautifully, with so much care and love. People were working 10 hours, 12 hours a day. A great dream was almost getting realized. And these people call that they are the ones who have civilized the world. They are not themselves civilized. They need civilization. Perhaps in the whole history of the Pope, only one Pope was honest. This Pope was Pope Leo X in the 16th century. He is reported to have said, "It has served us well, this myth of Christ." I'm not saying it. It is a statement from an infallible Pope. This myth of Christ has served us well. Certainly, it has profited you well. They have been talking about truth. But they have been hiding immensely important things. They have changed the whole gospel. They have edited everything that was going to be difficult for them. To argue for, to defend it. In the oldest versions of the Gospels, you will be surprised to know Judas was Jesus Christ, one of the brothers. He has two other brothers and two other sisters. But to keep Jesus' mother Mary without sin, they have dragged those daughters and those brothers completely, because either they have to bring the Holy Ghost 5 times, and that will be too much tiring for the Holy Ghost. And it is a remote control operation. Or they have to accept that Mary gave birth from Joseph, her legal husband. This Holy Ghost is illegal. And Jesus is an illegitimate child. They had dragged from the Gospels the very idea that Jesus has any brothers or any sisters. They had to keep Mariam or Mary or Maria, whatever name you give to Jesus' mother, Mohammedans call her Maryam, which looks to me the most beautiful. Greeks call her Maria. Ordinary Christians call her Mary. But to keep Mary without sin was necessary for a certain reason. Why God has chosen Mary to give birth to his only begotten son? Because she was without sin. It means on the whole earth there was no other virgin girl. Only Mary was virgin. It is such a condemnation of whole humanity. I have heard in a Christian church, the priest was asking, that virginity is our one of the foundations. And there were more women present than men. Men don't go to churches or temples or any other holy places. It is the women, because that is the only place where they can gossip with each other. They don't have any clubs, they cannot go to the restaurants, to the pubs. They have no social mobility, only the church. So out of necessity, because that is the only place where they can show their ornaments and their beautiful clothing and the fur coats and all kinds of gossips that are boiling within them, they don't go for Jesus Christ, for sure. And few husbands go there, not for Jesus Christ, either to keep an eye on their wife or to keep an eye on somebody else's wife. When the priest asks, out of all you women, how many are virgins? Stand up. Nobody stood up. The priest said, my God, nobody is a virgin? Then a woman with a small baby stood up. He said, you idiot, I am asking about virgins. You have already a baby. He said, the baby cannot stand. That is the only virgin in the church. I am not virgin, but this baby is 6 months old. She is still a virgin, believe me. But she cannot stand on her own. They say they are defending truth. They are defending lies. They don't mention in the Gospels that Judas was Jesus' brother. And one thing is certain, they go on condemning Judas that he betrayed Jesus for 30 silver pieces. But in the Gospels themselves, there is not a single word about condemnation of Judas. My own understanding is that he never betrayed Jesus. It was Jesus himself in his phonetic hallucination, Judas was trying to convince him that don't go at this moment in Jerusalem. It is Jewish holiday, and this is the time of the year when people are crucified. You will be caught. There are rumors all around. It is better not to go to Jerusalem at this moment. Let this festival pass, then you can go. But Jesus was absolutely fanatic. He said, don't you trust in God? This is a chance for the Jews to know that I am the only begotten Son of God. Let them crucify me, and God will do a miracle. And you have not been told that Judas was so much sad and sorry when Jesus was crucified, that second day he committed suicide, hanging himself by a tree. But Christians will not talk about the truth. They have to throw the responsibility on someone, but without any evidence from ancient scriptures. It is one of the most poisonous religions. It talks about one of the pillars of Christianity is forgiveness. It looks beautiful when you hear the word forgiveness, but the implications are very evil. A man rapes a woman. The man will be forgiven by God. What about the woman? The criminal is forgiven. What about the victim? Not a single mention that the victim will be rewarded or anything. A man murders and instantly goes to the priest and confesses. And the priest gives him a simple method, so cheap. You have murdered a man, put $10 in the charity box and 5 Hail Marys, and your sin is forgiven. God is compassionate. But what about the murderer? Nobody has ask the question to the Christians, what about the murderers? What God is going to do to the murderers? To the raped woman? To the molested child? And strangely enough, the same man will commit another murder, because now he is fresh. The old murder is erased, forgiven, in $10 and 5 Marys. Now he can commit another murder, he can commit another rape. All that he needs is to go and confess to the priest and give some money, and the priest will give him a prayer to do 5 or 10 times. There is nothing for a person who has been committing crime after crime and he is being punished. Not punished, he is being continuously forgiven. And all those people who have suffered from this man's crime, not a single mention in the whole Christian religion. It seems God is in favor of criminals, but not in favor of the victims. Now look again at the idea of forgiveness, and you will see that it is ugly. In other religions, Jainism, Buddhism, there is no God. And it is good that there is no God. Nobody can forgive. So there is no question of forgiveness. These religions are more scientific. Every action will have its reaction. Nobody can prevent it. You put your hand in the fire, and you will be burned. No God can prevent it. You rape a woman and you will suffer a deep wound of guilt. You may go mad, but you will have to suffer. Only suffering will cleanse you, not forgiveness. These religions are far more scientific. Taoism, Buddhism, Jainism. These three religions don't have any God. They don't have any hell, any heaven. They are purely scientific. Live according to your awareness, and there will be nothing like sin committed by you. Live unconsciously and you will suffer. It is unconsciousness that suffers, and there is nobody who can forgive you, because that forgiveness is in itself a criminal act, because the raped woman is suffering. Perhaps she gets pregnant, she has a child which she cannot love, she hates. It is out of rape that the child has come to her. No discussion at all about the very fundamental problem. Forgiveness is not the right thing. One who commits anything against existence has to suffer. One who helps existence to grow towards more beauty and more consciousness and more joy and more done should be rewarded not by any God, by his own act. In fact, when you do out of your awareness something good, the very action brings such blissfulness to you, such peace, such joy. You are rewarded in the action in itself. And if you do evil, that is only possible if you are not meditating. If you are an unconscious being in blindness, you may commit something which hurts someone, but then you have to take the responsibility and you have to suffer the reaction that is produced by your action. Christianity is absolutely unscientific. There is no future for Christianity. and they thought that they have given a sense of morality to the world. These are their questions they have sent to me. They have given a sense of morality to the world. And they don't read, it seems, even their own Bible. The Old Testament is full of pornography, far worse than any Playboy, Playgirl, or Penthouse. Of course, there are no psychedelic colors in the pornography, so you don't see it. You have to read it. There are 388 pages of pornography in the Old Testament. This is the biggest pornographic holy scripture. One of my friends, Ben Eckerley, has pulled out those 380 pages and created a book called the X-rated Bible. Now Christians all around the world are trying to ban the book, but it is already gone underground. It is moving. I have it. I will not say anything for which I don't have the right evidence. Just one instance of the pornography, 388 pages will be too long. It will make the record. According to the book of Samuel, King David, no ordinary person, very respected in the Old Testament, King David saw Bathsheba bathing from the roof of the palace. Great king. And thought she was beautiful. So he had her brought to him so that he could sleep with her. When she became pregnant, David called her husband back from the war. He was a soldier in his army. So that he could sleep with her and believe the child was his. But the husband did not sleep with her. So David had the husband Uriah sent to the front of the hottest battle so that he was killed. Then he married Bathsheba. As a punishment for this, the Lord threatened that he would take David's wife from him and give them to his neighbor, who would sleep with them in public view. Great punishment. God also seems to be pornographic. This is the old jungle's law, eye for eye. You have slept with somebody else's wife, all your wives, not one. David had many wives, he was a great king. All your wives will be taken away from you, and in public view, they will have to make love. Your neighbor. This is forgiveness. And what is the justification. He has slept only with one wife, all his wives, and what the wives have done. They have not slept with the soldier's wife. Why they are being punished? It is strange. David commits the sin, his wife will suffer the punishment. Great justice. Even an idiot can understand that this God is retarded. They have asked me that we have given the sense of morality to the world, that what Gautama Buddha was doing 500 years before Christ, what Mahavira was doing, what 24 Tirthankaras of Jainas were doing, what Lao Tzu, Chuang Tzu, Li Tzu were doing, they were all before Jesus Christ. And in fact, Jesus Christ has come to India hearing about Gautama Buddha. Although Gautama Buddha was dead, but he has left enlightened people, and there may be some few still who are enlightened, and Buddhist enlightened people have created two great universities, Nalanda and Takshila. Those were the first universities of the world. Oxford is only 1,000 years old. And Oxford has only 10,000 students. Nalanda has 50,000 students. Takshila has 100,000 students. And they were not ordinary students. They were sannyasins. And they were not learning scripture. They were learning meditation. They were learning how to enter into past lives and to find out what you have done in the past life. Those were great universities which were destroyed by Hindus, but Jesus came in the right time. He could meet enlightened masters in Nalanda and Takshila. He went to both the universities. It is on record. Far away in Ladakh, in the Himalayas, there is a Buddhist monastery which has a record of all the visitors. One of the visitors is Jesus to the monastery in Ladakh. 150 years ago, a Russian explorer reached to Ladakh, and he has written the whole page that was written about Jesus. That a man who was a Jew, young man, came and remained in the monastery, and he was tremendously beautiful, and he tried to learn everything of what Buddha had been teaching. He has visited Takshila and he has visited Nalanda, and he has seen enlightened people and learned from them many things. These are the 17 years that are missing from the Bible. 17 years he was here in India, in Ladakh, in Tibet. Whatever he has been teaching is borrowed from the East. You have not given a moral sense to humanity, even Christ has borrowed it from the East. And there is great similarity in his statements and Gautama Buddha's. But Gautama Buddha's statements have an authority which he does not have. For example, do unto others as you would have others do unto you. An ancient Buddhist proverb. But Christians brag about that very much. As far as I am concerned, whether it is Buddhist or Christian does not matter, it is wrong. It is wrong on psychological grounds. Do unto others as you would have others do unto you. If everybody was equal, similar, had the same desire, then perhaps this principle would have been right. But everybody is different. Your taste may not be the same as mine. Do unto others as you would have others do unto you. That's perfectly okay, but others' taste may be different. Everybody has unique personality. So I may do something which I like, but you may not return back. Your taste, your personality may be different. For example, take a masochist who loves to be tortured. That is his best joy, to be tortured. He reads this statement. Do unto others as you would have others do unto you. What will happen? He will start torturing you, hoping that you will in return torture him. But it is not necessary. You may be a weaker person, or perhaps you may be yourself a masochist, enjoying his torture and not doing anything. It is said the best couple, the perfect couple in the world is one in which one partner is a sadist and another partner is a masochist. But it is very difficult to find such a perfect couple, where one loves to be tortured and the other loves to torture. They fit. So if by chance it happens that you meet a sadist and you are a masochist, then this principle in that rare occasion will be right. Otherwise, it is not the rule. It looks beautiful, but it is unpsychological. It does not touch the depth of human psychology. People's tastes differ. They have asked that what I want to say about this, sanctify the Lord and let him be your fear and let him be your dread. And on the one hand, they go on talking about his forgiveness, his compassion, his love. And in this statement, they are saying, let him be your fear, and let him be your dread. This is fear, exploitation of man's fear and dread, to terrify him, to make him tremble. It is a well-known, documented fact that in the Middle Ages, there used to be Christian missionaries . They created such fearful scenes of hell, fire, eternal fire, devil torturing everybody in every possible way. And it is going to end never. And they shouted, and they beat the table, and they slammed the Bible on the table, and they created such fear amongst the women that after their sermon, that was their success, to count how many women have fallen unconscious, foaming, in a coma. The whole picture was so colorfully painted that they started trembling, because they all know they have committed sin. They have loved man, that is the greatest sin. They have not only loved their men, they have even desired other men. Because the Bible says, even your dreams will be counted. If in a dream you make love to your neighbor's wife, don't think God is not watching. He is the perfect witness of everything that is happening in the world. He is looking through every keyhole. He is looking even in your dreams. You are not even free to dream. You are not doing anything, just dreaming. Even your dreams will be counted on the day of judgment. As sins, no difference, equal, whether you have committed actually a sin or you have just dreamt about it, imagined about it, equal punishment. The whole Christianity lives on fear and greed. Those are human weaknesses. Man is afraid of death. Man is afraid what is going to happen beyond death. Man is afraid of his own desire, his tendency to love. Christianity exploits them, all other religions also exploit them in a minor way. Make people afraid and they will fall down on their knees, foaming with the mouth and raising their hands to God that forgave us. They will sanctify the Lord out of their fear and dread and create grief in them, that if you don't commit the sin, if you are afraid of God, all the pleasures that you can dream about will be yours in paradise. So on the one hand, fear, which is one of the basic paranoia of men, and on the other hand, greed. For fear is hell, for greed is paradise. The word paradise comes from Persian. In Persian, it is Firdaus. And Firdaus means a walled garden where kings used to enjoy hundreds of women, wine, a pleasure garden. Paradise is nothing but a changed form of Firdaus, walled garden of pleasure. So give people a carrot hanging far away beyond death, so they go on moving. That carrot, whether it exists or not, nobody knows, because nobody has returned from paradise to inform you what is true and what is untrue. And nobody has returned from hell either. So both are fictions, not a single witness. But by creating more fear, more dread, more greed, you can manipulate humanity into slavery. This is not morality. This is fear slavery. You are taking the dignity of human beings and you are destroying their beauty, their joy, their life, and filling it with all kinds of rubbish, poisons. They have poisoned almost the whole humanity. Even Mahatma Gandhi, I have looked deeply into his life and his actions. Perhaps not even his followers have gone deep into his mind. He was 1% Hindu. He was born a Hindu. He was 9% Jaina, because he was born in Gujarat, which is under the impact of Jainism. Even Hindus are under the impact of Jainism. And he was 90% a Christian. At least 3 times in his life, he wanted to become a Christian, but was persuaded by his friends that that will destroy our whole political fight for freedom. If you become a Christian, Hindus will not be with you. Neither Mohammedans will not participate under your guidance. So please don't do this. But what was the reason why he wanted to become a Christian? In his prayer, he continuously says, I am not afraid of anything except of God. That is a Christian idea that has become conditioned in his mind. Because he was educated in England for his law degree, and then he was in constant companionship with the Christians in South Africa. He came back to India when he was 40 years old, almost completely programmed by the Christians. And here, a great Christian missionary, C.F. Andrews, was continuously nagging him to become a Christian. Without being a Christian, you cannot reach paradise. And who would not like to reach paradise? Jesus says, anybody who goes to paradise goes through me. There is no other way. There is no other alternative. I had one of his sons, Ramdas, as my friend. And I used to talk to Ramdas whenever I used to go to Vardha to deliver lectures. That did not your father ever thought about? That God is love, that's what Jesus says. How you can be afraid of love? You can be afraid of everybody except God. And he was making just the contrary statement. But Christians are doing the same. He was repeating just Christian theology like a parrot. On the one hand, God is love. On the other hand, fear God and feel the dread. Then God is not love. Love dispels fear. Love dispels dread. Love is the only thing in the whole world which destroys all fear, all death. Love is the only alchemy that transforms you into an authentic religious person. Not fear. Fear creates only a slave. Fear and dread are the reasons of all psychopaths. The whole pathology that psychiatrists and psychoanalysts are treating is created by some kind of fear. But from the very beginning, the children are told, be afraid of God. He is seeing everyone. I have heard about a Christian nun who used to take his bath in a closed bathroom, keeping her clothes on. When other nuns found it, they said, are you mad? The doors are closed and there are only nuns around here. There is no man in the monastery. Why you take your bath keeping your clothes on? The nun said, God is omnipresent. He is in the bathroom too. So I am afraid. Such conditioning is bound to create pathology. I have told about militant Christianity. It is said, fight the good fight, onward, Christian soldiers. Is it a religion or an army? But it has been killing millions of people. They call them religious wars, holy wars, crusades. Mohammedans call their holy wars jihad, war for the God. God meets that millions of people should be killed. This statement comes from God or from Jesus Christ, who talks continuously of love, but now it is militant Christianity. Fight the good fight. Because it is a fight for God. Onward, Christian soldiers. Christianity does not create sannyasins, it creates soldiers. And these are the polar opposites. The monk who has come here belong to a certain sect of Christians, Jesuits. Their saying to every parent is, give us a boy of 7, not a girl. That's why you saw 21 soldiers, all male, not a single woman soldier. Give us a boy of 7 years and we will turn him into a good soldier of Christ. On the one hand, they go on saying that Christ is the pacifier, that he came to make the world at ease and in peace. And on the other hand, they are asking 7-year-old children, why? Because after 7 years, you can start conditioning and programming perfectly. The boy will be able to understand it. And by the age of 21, the programming will be complete. The time between 7 and 21 is the most vulnerable time. Because after 7, sexuality starts in a very small way. By the time 14, it is right. And as sexuality is your life energy, when it is beginning, that is the right time to fill your life energy with certain programs. Your mind is growing with your sex. It is not a coincidence that millions of people around the world have only the age, mental age, 7. From there, they have been filled with belief, Hindu, Christian, Mohammedan, and they lost their intelligence. There is no need of intelligence. They are given everything as a belief they don't have to explore. So they lose their growth of intelligence. I have called in America that Oregonians, where our commune was, are retarded people. The Attorney General from Meyer became very angry when he heard my statement. But the University of Oregon became interested that whether there is some truth what I have said. I have returned back to India, then their research and their survey came. They have done the survey of the commune while I was there. Then they surveyed all cross sections of Oregon society. And they were absolutely puzzled how I said it. Because all Oregonians' average mental age is 7 years. And the commune's mental age was double, 14. Those idiots decide an intelligent commune. And this 14 years is also because you are coming from conditioned family. I go on sharpening your intelligence, but you are already conditioned. That conditioning takes a little time. A man is capable of going hand by hand, soldier by soldier, his physical age and his mental age together. When he is 14, his mental age is 14. When he is 21, his mental age is 21. When he is 70, his mental age is 70. That will be the right growth program. But no religion wants people of such intelligence, because then they will see all the contradictions and all the superstitions and all the stupidities of your religion. And why they are asking a 7-year-old child? Because after 7 years, it is possible to program the child easily. He becomes vulnerable. He is growing in his sexual life. He becomes open. You can still feed any kind of nonsense and he will accept. It will become his bones, it will become his blood, it will become his marrow, it will become his mind. And he will never grow beyond the age 7. And they are ready to return the child by the age of 21. Because at that time, sexual energy comes at the highest peak when you are 17 and a half. That is the greatest power you have. After 17 and a half, you are on the decline. But 21, you have become too ripe now. To change you is very difficult. So they are ready to return the children by 21. Now nobody can change them. They have prepared them in good soldiers of Christ. But the very word of soldiers of Christ is so ugly. I teach you to be sannyasi, and not my sannyasi. It is your sannyas. It is your investigation into truth. And to be a soldier needs your mind to be starved at the age 7. Only retarded people can be soldiers, good soldiers. They won't ask any questions. They will simply follow the order. And every religion wants people who don't ask awkward questions, embarrassing questions which they cannot answer. I am here to answer all of your questions. You can find from any nook and corner of the world any question I am ready to answer. Because I have no investment in you. And I have no investment in any fold, any cult, any creed, any religion. My only love is to share the truth, the beauty, the godliness that I have found. It is overflowing. All I need is just a silent receptivity, a silent listening, and you will not be turned into soldiers of anybody. You will be an individual on your own feet, a sannyasin in your own right. A little biographical note before I start the sutras. Ungan was born in 782 and died in 841. He had entered Hayakujo's monastery at the age of 12. Later he left Hayakujo, going to Yaku-san, through whom he realized his enlightenment. Ungan's older brother, Dogo, joined Ungan as a monk when he was 46, having studied with the master Nehan, a disciple of Matazu. Dogo went to Yaku-san. He invited Ungan, his brother, to come and live at Yaku-san's monastery too. Ungan anticipated that Hayakujo would be reluctant for him to leave. But Hayakujo said, "That's right. An old saying runs, parents give me birth, friends give me growth." It is perfectly good, you can go. I have given you birth, now find friends who can help you to grow. This is a beauty in him. No competition. He does not know about this master Yaku-san. They lived 700 miles apart. Their monasteries were far away. But there is no question of fear. It is always good. He will learn something. Yaku-san may have a different angle of approach, and that will make him richer. Hayakujo said, "That's right. An old saying runs, parents give me birth, friends give me growth." Do you understand why I call myself your friend? Parents have given you birth, now I am going to give you growth. And only friends can give you growth. Because they don't have any condition. Their love is unconditional. They don't ask anything in return. Not even gratitude. You don't have to stay with me. You have stayed long enough. You are ready to move. Now you can go. A letter from Hayakujo with him, Ungan left immediately for Yakusan's monastery. That's Sutra. Our beloved master, once when Ungan was in Yakusan's presence, the master said to him, "What does Hayakujo Osho usually teach?" He does not know anything about Hayakujo, but still, a great scripture. Osho, Hayakujo, that great man, that great master, what he teaches. He has become Osho because he has allowed Ungan without any interference, that there is no need. I am an enlightened master. Where are you going? No, he simply said, it is perfectly good, you go. Be as rich as possible. Learn from as many masters as possible. It is a question of truth, not belonging to me. You are not my possession. I love you. I want you to grow higher than me. I want you to be more richer than I am. Have every opportunity. Never miss it. This statement and the letter made Yakusan call Hayakujo Osho. The man is certainly great. What does Hayakujo Osho usually teach? Ungan replied, he says, go beyond three phrases. What are the three phrases? Buddha's all the scriptures are divided in three sections. It is called three pratas, three baskets. These are called in Zen three phrases. Buddha is saying the same thing in all the scriptures, again and again, in different ways, different language, different angles, talking to different people, certainly different responses. This Tripitaka is known in Zen only three phrases, three different phrases. Yakusan said, what Hayakujo also teaches you? Ungan answered, he says, go beyond three phrases. Go beyond all the scriptures that Buddha has left behind you. Don't get caught into phrases, into words. You have to go beyond words. Scriptures are beautiful, but they cannot give you truth. First find the truth. Then if you want to enjoy the scriptures, you can enjoy. But first be rooted in the truth. And that rooting happens only when you drop your mind. Those three baskets of Buddha's phrases are contained in your mind. Go beyond. And sometimes he also says, go beyond six phrases and get it. What are the six phrases? Because Buddha told only three types of statements which have been collected into three scriptures. They are vast. Even one scripture is at least 1,000 pages. But because in India it has been a tradition, that whenever an enlightenment happens to a man, whatever he says is so beyond the ordinary mind that it has to be interpreted so that the ordinary human masses can understand it. So three scriptures have three commentaries that make six phrases. So Haya Kojo sometimes says go beyond three phrases, but if somebody is a scholar and has learned not only the original Buddha statement but also the interpretations of the scholars, then he says go beyond six phrases and get it. That is within you. Just you have to pass beyond all the words and it is already there, radiant, alive from eternity, waiting for you. Yaku-san commented, with a distance of 700 miles between us, fortunately we don't have anything to do with Hayakuja. Because he is unnecessarily harassing his disciples by telling them get beyond three scriptures, get beyond three scriptures and their three commentaries. A single statement is enough. Go beyond the mind. How you are going to calculate how much is in the mind? There may be those six and there may be many other scriptures. Why bother about it? Just simple statement, go beyond mind, and you have gone beyond all scholarship, all language, all intellectuality. You have entered into the no mind. So he said, there is 700 miles of difference between me and Haya Kojo. We don't have to do anything with Haya Kojo. But then he continued, what else does he teach? He suddenly must have remembered, this may not be the whole teaching. What else does he teach? Ungan said once, after the discourse when the congregation stood up from their seats, Haya Kojo called out to them, when they looked back at the master, Haya Kojo said, what is that? The sermon was finished. People were leaving. Their backs were towards Haya Kojo. And Haya Kojo called out to them when they looked back at the master. Haya Kojo said, what is that? Looking back? What is that? Yaku-san commented, you should have said that earlier. Haya Kojo is still doing well. Thanks to you, I was able to see Haya Kojo.
Just look back and you will find the Buddha. When Hayakujo called the monks who were leaving the assembly hall, their backs were towards him, he simply called them, they turned to look back at the master, and Hayakujo said, "What is that? Looking back?" This is the beauty of Zen. It does not get entangled into any unnecessary hypothesis. Just looking back. And Yaku-san said, "My God, why you did not say it before? I was having a wrong understanding about Hayakujo. That he is still concerned about, although he is saying go beyond the scriptures, but even going beyond is a concern about scriptures. Why not just forget and go beyond the mind?" But this statement is tremendous. When they all looked back, Hayakujo said, "What is that?" And in that small statement, "What is that?" And in that small gesture of looking back towards the master, the whole Zen is complete. Just looking back, you face the Buddha. Hayakujo is a Buddha. Every enlightened person is a Buddha. All that you need to do is look back. What you are doing in your meditation, looking back. And the deeper you look, the sooner you reach to the Buddha. Yaku-san commented, "You should have said that earlier. You gave me a misunderstanding about Hayakujo. Hayakujo is still doing well. Thanks to you, I was able to see Hayakujo, although the difference of 700 miles is there, but now there is no difference. Hayakujo is a master of the same caliber and status as I am. Seeing myself, I see Hayakujo, there is no difference. It is a beautiful anecdote. Britain wrote, "Loath to let spring go, birds cry, and even fishes' eyes are wet with tears. The spring is going away." The birds are crying, and even fishes' eyes are wet with tears. What Britain is saying, just as spring is so much loved by the trees and the birds and the fish, you don't know your inner spiritual spring. It has not come yet. You have not invited it. And the outer spring comes and goes, comes and goes, comes and goes, but the inner spring only comes and never goes. It is eternal spring. Its flowers are flowers of eternity. Once you are enlightened forever. There is no way of going there. How much splendorous and how much miraculous will be the inner spring. Even the outer is so great. Inner is not only quantitatively great, it is qualitatively great too. The search for truth is the search for inner strength. Manisha's question. Our beloved master, Bodhidharma, took Zen from India to China and Japan. You have brought it back to India, completing the circle. Is there some significance in this? Although India has been the starting point and perhaps the completion of the journey of Zen, in neither instance it seems as India itself been receptive to Zen. Would you like to comment? Manisha, Zen is the ultimate flowering of consciousness. It is started with Gautam Buddha. Giving a lotus flower to Mahakasya. In the statement, he told to all the sannyasins who were present that whatever I could say through words, I have told you. Whatever I could not manage to bring to language, I am transferring it to Mahakashyapa. With these words, visibly only the lotus flower was given to Mahakashyapa, but invisibly, Buddha transferred his unexpressed experience to Mahakashyapa. Mahakashyapa is the first Zen master. But neither Buddha was understood by India. The reason is clear. India is a land of great scholarship. It is a land of great scriptures. It is the ancient most land of the Brahmins. For 90,000 years they have been philosophizing. They have reached great intellectual heights. And Buddha jumps out of the Hindu fold. Not only jumps out of the Hindu fold, he jumps out of the mind. And the whole Hinduism is mind oriented. It is very intellectual. But it has no understanding of no mind. Through intellectual argument, it has come to conclusions that there is a soul, but it is not its experience. It is a philosophical hypothesis, Buddha for the first time makes religion experimental. For the first time transforms religion into a science of the inner. Just as objective science depends on experiments, not on intellect, the inner science depends on experience, not on intellect. So he went too beyond Hindu conception, which was so ancient and so old, and Brahmins were living on it. I have just quoted the Pope that the myth of Christ has profited us well. The whole Brahmin caste is 1/4 of the Hindus. It has been exploiting this country for centuries after centuries. Listening to Buddha, a cure for the Brahmins. Its scholarship will be thrown. Mind is no more needed, only meditation. It was a question of their livelihood. It was a question of millions of priests who have been exploiting and who have been sitting at the highest top of Hindu fold as the most superior class, the superman. Now Buddha is asking them to drop a great investment they could not manage. Rather, they dropped Buddha. Buddha disappeared from India. And if they could not understand Buddha, who has been talking for 42 years, arguing, making as possible for others to understand even that which is beyond the mind, he was trying to bring it into language, into logic. If they could not understand Buddha, how they will understand Mahakashyapa? Because Mahakashyapa never said a single word. He has simply laughed. That laughter was coming from beyond. Only Buddha could see it. He has among his 10,000 sannyasins so many intelligent giants. Mahakashyapa was very innocent, just like a child. Only he could understand, because there was no thought, no mind, no prejudice, no philosophy. He simply enjoyed being by the side of Buddha. People ask him questions that everybody is asking questions, why don't you ask? He will not even answer them. Finally, people have completely forgotten about him. He had a small tree which has become absolutely his. He had not said anybody, but everybody knew that don't sit under that tree, Mahakashyapa will be coming. He has been sitting there nobody knows how long. Never he asked anything, never he has any friendship with anyone. He has no society, but he seems very joyous. Either he is mad, or perhaps he has become enlightened, but Buddha has not confirmed his enlightenment. That day when he laughed, Buddha confirmed absolutely his enlightenment. Not only enlightenment, but he confirmed that this is the only mystic present in 10,000 people who can understand a guest. The lotus flower is a gesture. Hidden in the lotus flower, Buddha gave him everything that a master wants to share to his closest disciple. Zen was born in such mysterious circumstances, and nobody knows. There is no scripture that mentions any other instance about Mahakashyapa. Of course, Mahakashyapa could not be understood by a nation which is dominated by intellect and mind and priesthood for century after century. But China was a better ground because of Laos and Shantas and Laos. They have prepared the ground. There were people exactly like Mahakashyapa. So when Bodhidharma reached to China, the ground was ready. There were many people who could understand Bodhidharma's silence. And then Rinzai took it to Japan. Japan was even more innocent. Its ancient religion is Shinto. It is a very innocent religion with no dogma, doctrine, just a pure love for existence. This strange woman, Ishida, who is coming soon here within 2 or 3 days, is a seeress in an ancient Shinto temple. She is not a Buddhist. But Shinto is so innocent and simple that when Rinzai brought Buddhism, particularly Zen, from China, Shinto has no problem. It agreed absolutely that it is only innocence that knows the truth. We have not been so articulate as Zen masters are, but what they are saying, we know in the depth of our heart. So Shinto has no obstruction, no competition for a foreign religion, no struggle. So Shinto and Zen have grown together side by side. Zen masters go to Shinto temples and monasteries and live there. Shinto masters come to Zen monasteries and live there. Japan was even more peaceful and innocent. China had Lao Tzu, but it had also Confucius. Confucius has confused the whole problem. He was just a moralist. He knew nothing about the inner. But he was a predominant figure. Kings and princes, emperors asked his advice. He was a great intellectual. Because of his dominance, Chana was not so innocent. A small stream of cow immediately welcomed Bodhidharma as if Lao has come back, their old master. They sign Bodhidharma's eyes the same sign, the same death, the same mystery, the same dance. Tao and whatever Bodhidharma has brought in Pali, it is called Dhan. In Sanskrit, it is called Dhyan. Dhan and Tao met, and out of their meeting, Zen is produced. Zen is a cross breed, and the cross breed is always better than the parents, both the parents. And when Lingzai took in China, Zan became Chan, and in Japanese it became Zen. It has come very close again back to Buddha's word Zan. And certainly I am bringing Zen back to India. And the circle is complete. If it is started with Mahakashyapa, it is coming to its ultimate flowering with me. But neither Mahakashyapa has been understood, now I am going to be understood. This misunderstanding of the masses is a proof that I am starting something valuable, something of the ultimate truth. I know a very strange man, Mahatma Bhagwan Ji. In India, there were only two Mahatmas, Mahatma Gandhi and Mahatma Bhagwan Ji. I am absolutely against Mahatma Gandhi on every point. Sometime I am going to take care of him. But with Mahatma Bhagwan Ji, I had a deep friendship. He was old, I was too young, just a student in the university. Then we met. He had come to give a talk in the university. There I was a student. And he was talking and quoting from scriptures. And he was a very great orator of his time. But I have always been a difficult person. I stood up in the middle and I said to him, "Stop for a moment." He looked at me. I said, "Do you have anything to say on your own authority, or you are still going to quote from scripture?" there was great silence. The Vice Chancellor felt bad. He knew that I cannot resist the temptation. Mahatma Bhagwan Deen was shocked. For the first time somebody had interrupted him in the middle. But he was an honest man. He said, "You are right. I don't have anything on my own system." That was the beginning of a great friendship of a young man with an old man. And we used to meet often. He used to stay with me in the house. I used to stay with him in his house. It was not far away. It was only 6 hours by car. Any moment I wanted to go, I will simply drive from Jabalpur to Nagpur. He lived in Nagpur. And he forgot completely that I am too young and he is too old. Even his host, because he has no home, he was a sannyasi. He was living with his friend. Even his host used to say it is a strange kind of friendship. You are too young, he is just going to die. But when you both talk together, even we who listen forget the difference between your ages. And by chance, the day he died, I was present just few hours before. I was coming from Chanda, and just in the train, one man, Kamal Nain Bajaj, he was the son of Jamnalal Bajaj. And Jamnalal Bajaj was the host of Mahatma Gandhi. He had taken him from Sabarmati, Ahmedabad to Wardha. Wardha is just between Chanda and Nagpur. I was coming from Chanda. On the station of Wardha, Kamal Nain entered into my compartment. He was a member of parliament. He told me, "Do you know that Mahatma Bhagwan Deen is very seriously ill?" I said, "I have no idea." He said, "I am going to see him." I said, "I will then get down in Nagpur." I was not going to get down in Nagpur. I was going directly by train to Jabalpur. So I got down. I went to see him. I could not believe my eyes. I have not seen him for almost 1 year. He has become just a skeleton. Just skin and bone. Nothing else was left. And he was continuously coughing blood. He looked at me and he smiled. He said, "This was my last wish. That if existence has any compassion to me, somehow, I would like to see you." That was my continuous heartfelt desire since the last day.
And it is a miracle you have come. I wanted to say something to you because I know I am not going to stay longer, maybe 2 hours. And after 3 hours he died. He said to me that you had asked a question while you were a student many years before in the university. And I had to confess before thousands of students and hundreds of professors that I don't have anything on my own to say. I want you to know, I still don't have anything on my own to say. I remain a scholar. I am dying in deep misery. I did not listen to you. I argued and argued and quoted the scriptures and never took the point, although I felt you were right. But my age, my prestige prevented me to ask you how to know it, how to get to it. It was a simple question and you were always available, but because I never asked, you never said anything. We discussed and discussed, but that was all intellectual. I said, I was waiting without your being thirsty for it. It is not possible for anyone. You can take the heart to the river, but you cannot force the heart to drink the water. I had tried in every way to take you to the river. That's the end of the master's work. Now the river is ahead of you. If you are thirsty, drink. If you don't feel like thirsty, I'm helpless. He had tears in his eyes. Tears of a long life wasted in the world. And because of his scholarship, he has been called Mahatma, great soul. And he had no idea of any soul as an experience. This country is too full of knowledge, too much burdened with scholarship, too much dominated by the priest. One thing he said, the last thing before I left him, he said to me that if the crowd agrees with you, no, you are wrong. Just remember it as advice from an old friend. If the crowd disagrees with you, there is a chance of your being right. The crowd has never been right. Hence you don't see the Indian crowd here. You see individuals from all over the world, few individuals from India too. But this is not a crowd. This is a meeting place of seekers. You have come on your own in search . India is too much egoistic. Because it has all the great scriptures and all the great priests who parrot-like go on repeating great words, and they are satisfied with those words. They will die a miserable death like Mahatma Bhagwan did. Manisha, nothing can be done about it. but it does not matter. The crowd has never mattered as far as ultimate truth is concerned. It is an individual search. And the people who are in search have come to me from all over the world. Neither Buddha has such an audience. It was confined to the state of Bihar, not of even the whole of India, nor Mahakashyapa had such an audience international, nor Bodhidharma, nor Rinzai. I am the most blessed one in the sense that I have the chosen few of the earth from all over the planet. It is a gathering to be rejoiced with. I am absolutely blissful to have you here. This is certainly a good completion of Mahakashyapa. He started the circle, I am completing it. And you are the witnesses of a great phenomenon. Now it is the time for Sardar Gurdayal. He has started laughing. Not even before the joke, but in the middle of the sutra. He is very sensitive. And he trusts me that my time is coming. Finally, Ronald Reagan is retired into private life. After leaving the White House, he and Nancy return to living normal life on their ranch in California and are just as happy as little rats. One day, Ronald decides he wants to take Nancy shopping. So he gets her into the car and they drive to the local shopping mall. Then Reagan takes Nancy into the huge dingbat department store. As they walk in, Ronald looks up and sees a sign by the door that reads, "Please leave your bag outside." "Gee, Nancy," says Ronald, turning to his wife, "sorry, but you will have to wait here." Bouncer, the British bulldog, is sniffing his way around the neighborhood when he recognizes the smell of Alvin, the American Airedale. After the two dogs have met and sniffed each other thoroughly, Alvin, the American dog, starts to speak. "The trouble with you British," barks Alvin, "is that you are far too tribal and interbred. There should be much more intermingling. For instance, in my blood, there is British, German, Spanish, Italian, French, and a touch of Chinese." "I say, old chap, replies Bonesir, how jolly is flirting of your mother. Little Bangi Barki finds himself being sent by his Catholic Indian parents to the Holy Jesus Jesuit Gemini Seminary in Pune. Life is tough in the seminary for Bangi, and he has a lot of trouble adapting to life related to Christianity. Everywhere there are crosses on the walls with Jesus hanging off them. There are pictures of Jesus everywhere, on the walls, in the windows, and in all the books. Jesus is omnipresent. In all sorts of postures and poses, the monks who run the seminary talk all the time of Jesus. One day, little Bangi has a problem. Can you help me fix my bicycle, Father Stickle? He asked one of the old priests. My son, Jesus loves you, replies the priest, pointing at a picture of Jesus riding a donkey. Just trust in Jesus. Jesus will find a way. The next day, little Bangi is sitting in the schoolroom during nature class, thinking about his broken bicycle. Suddenly, Father Felony asks little Bangi a question. Now tell me, Bangi, says Father Felony, what is brown, has a long bushy tail, jumps through the branches of trees and eats nuts? Well, replies Bangi, in the real world, it is obviously a sparrow. But in this place, things are so fucked up, it is bound to be Jesus. Close your eyes and feel your body to be completely frozen. This is the right moment to look inward. Gather all your life energy, your total consciousness, and thus towards the center of your being with an urgency as if it is going to be your last moment on the earth. Faster and faster. Closer you come to yourself, deeper becomes the silence. Nearer you reach to your center, a great peace arises within you. And the moment your arrow of consciousness penetrates into the center,
for the first time you encounter your original face. The other name of your original face is the Buddha, the awakened one. The only quality of the Buddha is witnessing. Witness, you are not the body. Witness, you are not the mind. Witness that you are not other seven astral bodies, layer upon layer behind the physical body. Witness finally that you are only a witness. At this moment, you are the most blessed people on the earth. Centered at your being, you are no more Buddha is. That is your ultimate and eternal nature. To make the witnessing more deeper, Nivedana, relax, let go, but remain a witness. Just a witness. Time disappears. Mind disappears. Slowly, slowly your consciousness starts melting. All differences with existence disappear. Gautam the Buddha auditorium becomes an ocean of consciousness without any ripple. A tremendous ecstasy. A great drunkenness. And you are at home. This is the very essence of Zen. I call Christianity the deadliest poison and Zen the only antidote for all poison. This is the only possibility of liberating you of bringing your Buddha from the seed into a lotus flower. Collect as much experience, as much ecstasy and the juices of your life, because from the center you are connected with the cosmos. You have to bring all that with you. So your day-to-day life becomes more blissful, more serene, more silent. If you can persuade the Buddha to come with you, you will feel continuously a coolness in you. You will feel the eternal depth of being and the ultimate height of the being. If the Buddha comes with you, you will have a transformation from horizontal to the vertical. The vertical is the goal. Horizontal is to live only in the outside. And the real life is in. The real godliness is in, and it is here and now. Persuade the Buddha to come along with you as a shadow. Slowly, slowly you will melt into him. He will become the reality and he will become the shadow. That day, the journey is complete. The antidote has succeeded. And the poisons of all kinds of conditioning, Hindu, Christian, Mohammedan, are erased. You are out of the jail, out of the cage, you can open your wings and the whole sky is your. All the stars and the moon and the sun belong to you. You can disappear into the blueness of the beyond. Once you know you are a Buddha, you will never be born in any kind of body, in any kind of imprisonment, no birth, no old age, no sickness, no death. You simply become a pure consciousness, eternal, timeless. The only quality that remains is witnessing. To be a witness of everything is the key, the master key to open all the mysteries of existence. Nivedana, come back, but come as Buddhas, with the same grace, the same silence, the same joy, the same beauty, and sit for a few moments just to remember where you have been. The golden path that you have traveled to the center, and all that happened at the center, don't forget it. It is not a dream. It is the only reality, the only truth, and truth liberates. Love liberates. Blissfulness liberates. And when you have all these in abundance, they automatically start flowing around you, and you share them not as a duty but out of your abundance. When something is done out of your abundance, it makes you richer. The more you give, the more you have. The evening has been beautiful on its own, but your silence, your looking back towards the Buddha has made it a great splendor, a silent song, a celebration. Only your heart knows. The mind is absolutely unaware of it. I can hear your heart beat at this moment is in deep synchronicity with the whole existence. This is what Vyapu-san calls, isness is my business. Okay, Manisha?